The following KOPN podcast is made possible by the generous donations of listeners like you. Please consider a donation to listener-supported community radio, KOPN. You can donate securely on our website at kopn.org.
Welcome to Thought Crime Radio, and something's wrong with his microphone. Can't seem to get it oriented here. Thank you. Welcome to Thought Crime Radio. We today are going to talk about food security. We don't like to take things for granted on this show. We don't value the word of self-described authorities much, especially when they have a proven track record of deception and self-serving corruption. American obstetrical medicine and circumcision, for instance, or the federal government's fairy tale about the 9/11 attacks, or the legitimacy of the secret government, which controls our economic and political systems through the funny money manufactured out of empty promises by the Federal Reserve. Empty promises, as in it's not federal and there is no reserve. Calling the motivations of our public servants into question makes people exceedingly uncomfortable, but the corruption and treason is getting so blatant that the coincidence and random corruption theorists are starting to look downright silly. While the so-called free press uses meaningless phrases like jobless recovery and parades around bearded sock puppets bearing a remote resemblance to Western intelligence agent Osama bin Laden, we continue to be increasingly dependent on the kindness of strangers for our most basic necessities. Our standard of living has dropped by two-thirds since the 70s. American jobs continue to hemorrhage overseas with federal government blessing. Our public schools are looking increasingly like indoctrination and ignorance factories and social Darwinist culling operations. Whatever you believe about the motivations of the powers that be, it's pretty obvious that what's going on in this country is not compatible with democracy or sustainability. And I'm sorry, but carrying around anti-war signs only puts your name in a government database. It's not that there's a shortage of ideas. Here's an excerpt from an interview with William Grider, which was broadcast on PBS's Now show recently.
There are two competing globalizations. One is a globalization of corporate power. The other is a globalization of people power. And they are diametrically opposed to one another in competition. So this is not about building isolated economies. We still need trade, but at the margin, not as the foundation of our economy and certainly not the foundation of our food system, but a whole planetary system of local living economies that are connected to each other, trading at the margins, but most importantly, sharing their ideas, sharing their technology freely, so that the whole of the economy, the whole of the species and of global society can evolve with the speed that is necessary if we're going to create a future in which we bring ourselves into balance with Earth's biosphere. Create a world in which the needs of everyone are met, and at the same time do this within a framework of democracy and real citizen sovereignty and local control. This is what in Bali we call a living return. It's a return to the owner that is not just the financial return, which is necessary to maintain the business, but in addition to an honest and adequate profit, it is the return that the owner gets personally from living in a healthy community with a healthy natural environment. And that's a whole shift in perspective that you can only get with what I call living owners of living enterprises that live in relationship to the community. This is only one example. I mean, that's what's so exciting about being part of this local living economies movement, is there are thousands and thousands of business people out there now that are responding in exactly the same way in terms of what gives them real satisfaction in their lives. And it's a beautiful thing to see.
Just about everybody watching this wants to know, okay, that's fine, but will it get me a job?
Actually, the real issue is livelihoods, our means of living. A job is one means of living, but it is a means of living that depends on money as the intermediary. Now, one of the things I find fascinating is that there's an amazing move of young people back to the land, back to farming, back to connecting with nature. And part of what they're doing is rediscovering the household as a unit of production. And the more of their own food that we produce, the more food that we produce within our community, again, the less we are dependent on the money system that Wall Street controls, and the greater control we have over our lives. Yeah, we need to move beyond thinking about jobs. It's livelihoods, it's entrepreneurship, it's all the ways of creating our means of living together, some of which will involve paid employment.
But if I were to ask, how does this scale up? Your answer is, actually, it already is.
It's already scaling up. There are three essential elements. One is changing the story of our economic possibility, the story of what is the proper purpose of the economy. The second is creating the new reality from the bottom up, creating it by doing it, which is what's happening in Bellingham. And the third is then, as we change the story, create the new reality, we build the political power to change the rules so that they favor the Main Street economy over the Wall Street economy.
A wonderful group of women in Austin, Texas, who've just graduated from a kind of six-week course to teach about worker-owned co-ops, and so they started one themselves. What do you make of this model of worker ownership in using a co-op?
You know, I think worker ownership is the wave of the future, various forms of co-ops, which is about democratizing ownership and rooting it in community in ways that can also scale, because you can do larger scale enterprises that require more capital but also still maintain the roots in the community. So I think it's a very powerful piece of the cutting edge. You can also have co-ops of co-ops. So you can organize whole industries like Organic Valley around a co-op model, all built around enterprises that are locally owned, either by individual owners or cooperatively owned. And I'm particularly fascinated when you talk about scale. Experiences like in northern Italy with what they call the manufacturing networks, where you have hundreds or thousands of smaller enterprises that are rooted in community, but they join together to do larger projects that one company could not do on its own. So you could imagine, even organizing the construction of a new transportation systems and so forth in ways that that maintain this principle of local ownership and broad democratic participation.
Unfortunately, such visions of community and sustainability are off the table under our current political and economic systems, which are under the control of the money changers, whose most visible organ is the so-called Federal Reserve. But it turns out that one of the biggest owners of the Fed, the recipient of $25 billion of taxpayer bailout money, who spent the most on congressional lobbying among the bailout banks in this past year, happens to have a soft underbelly. I'm talking about J.P. Morgan. J.P. Morgan is a huge player in the market manipulation game. One of its biggest operations involves the suppression of the price of silver, which is widely recognized as a sensitive barometer of the value of the Federal Reserve notes. Max Keiser, the economic analyst on the net, has pointed out a way for peace, democracy, and sustainability activists to make a difference in the real world, to put their money where their mouth is.
Hi, this is Max Keiser, host of the Keiser Report. I want to talk to you about this global viral campaign, Crash J.P. Morgan, Buy Silver. The fact is that J.P. Morgan is a huge player in the derivatives market. They've got a balance sheet exposure of something like $1.5 trillion. A lot of that is tied to their silver shorts. That is to say, they have sold silver contracts that don't exist. They're engaged in naked short selling. This is a form of counterfeiting. Huge hedge funds around the world are buying lots of silver because they know that if they force J.P. Morgan to have to buy silver in the open market, they're going to make money. So what I'm saying is you can piggyback on these huge players. All you need to do is buy one silver coin, maybe two silver coins, demand physical delivery of that silver, thus forcing J.P. Morgan and these other financial terrorists to have to cover their negative bets and put a company like J.P. Morgan basically forcing them into bankruptcy, because there's no way they can cover their liabilities if we all buy one silver coin and demand physical delivery. Put J.P. Morgan, a financial terrorist, out of business. Buy silver.
On the line with me today is Ruel Chappell. He is with the Well-Fed Neighbor organization in Springfield, Missouri, which is concerned with local food security so that we're not quite so dependent on the kindness of strangers to feed ourselves. And Ruel, are you there?
Yes, sir, I am. I'm having a little hard time hearing. We just had a tornado here. So it's kind of crazy right now. But I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Yes, loud and clear.
Good.
Thank you. Also in the studio with me, I have Adam from Columbia Center for Urban Agriculture, who they recently put on a spectacularly successful food extravaganza at their location in Columbia. Adam, can you hear me?
Yes, I can. I'm right here. Thank you very much for having me.
That's not a simulation across the way here. Okay. And also, I have my co-host, Janelle.
Hello. My mic on?
Oh, yeah. I believe so. Participated with our expose of American obstetrical abuse for many months on this show. Let's get right into it. Ruel, it's my understanding that Missouri is not capable of feeding itself. Is that pretty much the case?
Yes. The fact of the matter is, I was listening to the gentleman before you, and I couldn't catch his name. In fact, I'd never heard the gentleman speak, but it was almost like taking the words out of our very our own philosophy right here in Springfield, is that, we've come to know that we can't feed ourselves. In fact, no place in the United States can. We are now net importers of food from China, net importers of products from China, and China finances at last blush about $900 billion of our debt. The fact of the matter is we're not sustainable in any way, shape, form, or fashion. We went early on 2 years ago to started talking to politicians as they were beginning their run for office, but that just didn't pan out. We didn't get any kind of feedback or commitment or anything like that. And so we just I turned my whole focus to just talking to people here in Springfield. And over the last 2 years, we have built a very, very big, strong base of just grassroots support. We speak to about 5,000 people a day, and people become more and more aware of the fact that food is at the basis of every major problem we have, and it is our only single solution to all of our problems. In other words, if we can relocalize, and that's what the Well-Fed Neighbor Alliance is about, is relocalizing a food supply, thus securing our food, giving rise to a vibrant, sustainable local economy with jobs, and improving the health of our community. We believe, in just a few words, that the only way we, America, will ever be strong again is doing just what we're doing in around metropolitan areas and making America strong again, one city, one county, one state at a time.
Sounds like a laudable goal, something long overdue, and it's a shame that the politicians don't seem to be receptive to this yet.
Well, you know, and I don't want to step on anybody, so you're going to have to speak up if I am, because I can't hear real loud. So, but the one thing that we have found, and, you know, I grew up in the ad business, and I play with a group called the Ozark Mountain Daredevils, and I'm sure none of you are old enough to remember that, but I grew up in the recording studios, and marketing became part of my, became how I made my living. And one thing is, speaking with politicians is kind of like dating. You know, everyone wants to be with who doesn't want to be with them. So if you ignore people like that, all of a sudden they become interested. And now we have no problem. In fact, the people I've spoken to, Vilsack, I've spoken to the director of agriculture of Missouri on several different occasions now. And so the thing is, I guess what I'm saying is, if you are successful on the ground, they can't afford not to be part of that. So we've all of a sudden we've become, you know, interesting to them. And we just go under the assumption that, you know, I owe no allegiance to any political party, religion, or belief system. We just support the people that support us. And that's that. It's just that simple.
Okay, and also in the studio here, we have Adam from the Columbia Center for Urban Agriculture. And like I said, had a wonderful free meal several weeks ago that I managed to get in on.
Yeah, that was our Harvest Hootenanny on the 30th of last month. And that was there to celebrate the end of our first year at our urban farm here in Columbia. We've got about an acre and a half of space donated by Mark Stevenson. He's been really great to work with. He's owns a lot of property here in town and has been really generous with us and with the community gardens. And about this time last year, we started talking to Mark about putting this land into production, and he allowed us to do that, and we got running earlier in 2010 and opened up our market to sell produce 3 days a week. We give tours for people and for schools. And we do workshops there. We do a lot of volunteers, events out there. We have interns come out and learn. Our main goal of Columbia Center for Urban Agriculture is education. Do skill building and train people and get hands-on experience with food production. And being located in the city and with this urban farm is really a key piece of the puzzle, because it's very accessible for people. A lot of people can walk or ride their bike or pop in very quickly. It's not a really long commute to come out to our farm and work with us. So that's been a great model for us thus far. We're looking forward to our next year, 2011, our second year at the farm. We learned a whole lot on how to be more productive and how to get more food out into the community, selling through our stand and through restaurants and things like that.
And just as important is your outreach program to teach people how to grow their own food. Right.
That's right. Yeah. That's our one of our main goals is to do food production with people so that they get the confidence to go out there and start a garden, whether it's small or large, and to get those skill building parts up. I think what urban agriculture is going to play a role in the big picture over the coming decades is that a lot of people my age, in their 20s, are going to get a connection back to farming through urban agriculture, because it's very accessible, it's very easy to get involved and to organize and to grow food and to work with people. And they'll get that, they'll feel that in their roots that of food production, and they'll want to be farmers, and they'll get larger spaces in and around cities, or move out and get larger pieces of land where they can raise cattle or whatever it may be. I think that's where our next generation of farmers, I think a lot of them are going to get inspired through very small intensive agriculture, of primarily vegetables.
And one of the frequently overlooked segments of our population in terms of planning and allocating resources is the children, of course. And Janelle is here to tell us about a new initiative to give babies access to breast milk, which they would normally otherwise have to do without and rely on industrialized junk food to survive. Janelle, can you go into that?
Sure. As Ro was talking about the root of our issues is food, and the first food of the human being is breast milk, human breast milk. And you know, along with what you were saying, Adam, that you know, getting people out in their yards and in the dirt and farming young people, I think that even before that, if these people were also breastfed, if their mothers were eating the organic vegetables and bay and fruits and they were self-sustainable, and then they had breast milk, we're even going to make a bigger impact on the planet. Because right now, we're kind of coming out of it, but in the past, it was believed that female breast milk, human breast milk, was deficient. So we were told, you know, in the 50s and 60s and 70s, and even recently, that it's better formula and man-made chemicals and cow milk and soy milk are better for a human being than human milk. So we want to inject that into the discussion about how we can create the healthiest humans on the planet that we possibly can. And people who are breastfed are going to naturally seek out natural, wholesome, healthy food rather than the store-bought, chemicals, processed, pasteurized. And we can see that now in the home birth community. As soon as people start having a non-medicalized birth and they don't circumcise and they breastfeed their babies, they begin to look at, well, what about my food source? What about my water source? What about the environment? What about education, public school education? So a lot of people are really moving towards a really, really natural, holistic approach in all aspects of their life. And I think that for both of these projects and a lot of the self-sustaining projects, it would be really good to include the breastfeeding mothers to support them and to include them. And then the initiative that Rich was talking about is a woman that I had on my other show, Mama Rep, on Saturdays. Her name is Emma Kwasniska. She's from Montreal, and she started a global network called Eats on Feeds, which is a woman-to-woman sharing of breast milk, eliminating the middleman, the milk banks, and money. And it's women donating their breast milk to other women and babies so that every baby has the potential to have breast milk as a first alternative. And we're really proud that we unveiled that program here on KOPN on October 30th because she made Time Magazine this week. Just really amazing.
It's this breast milk facade. You know, this it's one of the most destructive lies I can imagine. Is exposing a baby to something that babies were never designed to deal with. You know, like more than 50% of formula is some form of sugar. Back in the 1910, 1920, formula basically consisted of starch and water and sugar. You know, this is the cluelessness. It hasn't gotten much better since then, believe it or not. Breast milk contains immunological, nutritional, and the psychological aspect of being held and breastfed. These are all very important to a baby.
Well, it was made, human breast milk is made for the human baby. Cow's milk is made for a cow. Cats make cat milk. And so what we know now is that a woman can walk into a room, a new room, a strange room, and her body will detect what's going on in that room, and she will create milk that will help protect that baby from anything in that room that the baby's not been exposed to before. The breast milk is a profound, profound food that is designer made for that baby. That mother that made that baby, her body made that baby, her body makes the milk for that baby. And if she can't, then the only next best thing is another woman's milk, not a cow, not a soybean, not sugar, not chemicals. And, you know, I hope that we can begin to weave these different programs of sustainability together. Like the local urban farmers work with the local breastfeeding groups and the Eats on Feet group, so that any woman that's pregnant and breastfeeding can also be a part of the gardening and learning how to garden. And
that's right. That's something that we want to do, is reach out to everybody, because that's a skill that's a human skill that people can gain in food production, and it just takes some practice. And there's a lot of people who love gardening and will love to teach about gardening too.
And if you don't, I'm presuming that people will work with someone who's never done it before.
Of course, that's in there's many community gardens located around Columbia and all over the country. Where there's groups of people working small plots together. And that's a good model, because you can talk to your neighbors who have gardened next to you and ask for advice.
And have fun. What's wrong with that?
Exactly.
You know, yeah.
It's not.
Get some vitamin D out there in the sun.
Exactly. Well, that's a subversive right there. We're not supposed to need vitamin D, according to the powers that be. So, Roel, one of the reasons I called you earlier this week about this show was this Senate Bill 510.
Uh-huh.
I was wondering if you could go into the content of this bill and how it pertains to people's ability to control what they take into their own bodies.
Well, the thing of the bill that frightens me more than anything is just the fact that I know that most of that bill came from was lobbied and was initialized in a corporate mindset. In other words, that's the way that corporations they compete with us now. They compete through legislation. In other words, over the last 70 years, we have gone from a situation where small communities existed and vendors existed in that community to serve the people of that community, and you did business with them, and they made a living wage and they provided a good service, and therefore you patronized them, and that's the way it was, because you needed them. In other words, you needed a blacksmith, you needed a general store, you needed the farmers to put food in that general store, you needed, you know, and you needed each and every one of those people. So you could not stamp, you know, or tamp their price down to the point that they couldn't exist. There was nothing wrong with doing business. There was nothing wrong with bargaining for the best price you could get. But at some point in time, you have to allow that person to make a living wage. Now, when we went to the larger corporations and the consolidation of business and the consolidation of markets, through big box stores and offshoring to jobs and production to garner those efficiencies that allows them to drive the price down, we went to a very adversarial way of doing business. In other words, competition became destruction. In other words, if someone is competing with you, you had to destroy them. You had to not only make them go out of business, but eliminate the opportunity for anyone to take over that business or resurrect that business. Case in point is Missouri used to be 100 years ago, fed the world its tomatoes, Southwest Missouri. From 200 tomato canneries located in Southwest Missouri around the Springfield area in our food shed. None of those canneries exist today. When I was a kid in the 50s, early 50s, we got a lot of the food that our milk, our beef, our, you know, a lot of our produce came from farms around the city. Now, that's not true anymore. Back then, we had a lot of processing. And, you know, we had to process potatoes, process tomatoes, process beef, process all the things that made it, you know, created the further processed products that we bought. Like, in other words, you might buy a beefsteak at a butcher shop, but then, you know, if you wanted hot dogs or you wanted a sausage or you wanted those further processed things, they had to go through a processing plant. Well, all of those, when the corporations consolidated, were bought up and not opened or manned or for the purposes of employing the community. They were closed. Why did that happen? Because they don't want anyone competing against them. So the thing about 510 in a nutshell, without going into getting off in the tall weeds, is the fact that it is a bill that in our mind is burdensome once again to the small producer. The Well-Fed Neighbor Alliance is hinging its entire outlook and mission and vision on the resurrection of the small producer. And, you know, the self-policing that comes with that, you know, we don't need a lot of government oversight to grow tomatoes here. As far as I know, no locally grown tomato ever killed anybody. That's not so true of the big providers that are once again too big to fail, like the banks that we bailed out. The government doesn't watch them very well. There's salmonella and listeria and all kinds of recalls on a daily basis. So, I would rather talk about the good things that we're doing, but this is the one thing that we have raised a lot of objection to, and we've kind of asked all of our people listening to us to write in, email in, and ask the senators to vote no on S-510. There's many more to come. This is just the first. But we are convinced that if we put an economic engine on the ground in Springfield, Missouri, and I can talk at length. I don't want to usurp all the time, but if we put an economic engine on the ground, that is hard to stop. And if you've got the backing of the people, if the people see the value in the fact that if they demand local food and they buy local food and local food's produced, we produce an economy that provides jobs. And processing will once again be needed. And all of those things will require people. And so we build that livelihood that the gentleman earlier in your program was talking about, where we create an economy that will support a community, and that's all. And if we create those strong local economies all over the United States again, then we'll once again be as strong as we were. But we will never be strong as long as we rely on a global economy. And I'd be happy to answer. I mean, the Well-Fed Neighbor is kind of acting as a hub, and we have a model that's pretty unique, and I don't know exactly how far in depth you want me to go, but the long and short of it is the reason I dislike S-510 and oppose it is because it is burdensome to the small producer, and I view it as a direct strategy for competition from corporations.
Well, one of the aspects of a localized economy is that there's a feedback loop going on. The businesses, in terms of trust, I mean, the businesses involved in the local, local farmers, shoe manufacturers, whatever, they depend on their reputation to be able to sell their product. And if they sell contaminated product that makes people sick, word gets around very quickly in a localized economy. Whereas in the current economy, this could be happening in China. They could be, you know, adding this plastic additive that simulates protein content to nutritional tests, and it turns out to be toxic to the kidneys. I can't remember the name of this chemical, but melamine.
Sure.
Yeah. And they discovered that this was being deliberately added to even baby's milk in China. And how is a person here in Columbia, Missouri, who is completely, you know, dependent on the federal government, you know, which is essentially a very corrupt institution at this point, you know, who are they going to turn to? They'd have to hire their own biomedical lab to analyze the food that they get if they really wanted to be sure what was going on, because there is absolutely zero accountability in any of this.
Exactly. Well, I mean, obviously, I mean, why should we expect accountability from China in any way, shape, form, or fashion? They don't recognize. I mean, I'm a musician. They, you know, the black market of videos and CDs and music and everything is one of the leading industries. They gorge the world with and there's no, I mean, they don't have to adhere to patents or copyright or anything like that. You know, so I mean, why in the world would we expect them to be truthful about our food? And right there is the key. We are, if you form a local economy, you build a local food system, you build a complete circle, and you know that everyone can that can be involved in, and it is based on the truth. That's it. That's not. In other words, if we sell a black Angus cow for beef, we will say that is Angus. Now, if you go buy Angus anywhere else from anyone else, are you aware that the spec for that is beef from a cow with one black side? That's a legal definition. And so Angus beef does not necessarily even have to be from an Angus cow. I could go on and on and on and on, but what I'm saying is that when we say local, it will be local. When we say whatever it is, it will be exactly that. And then we'll, on that, I will compete with any big box store as to when they say local, what do they mean? When they say natural, what do they mean? And this is the way to do it. I mean, this is the way we will give our local stores a point of differentiation that big box cannot buy. And we want to do... And we want to do it in a 10 to 15% price point increase so that it's not unaffordable. And we want to help the farmer, I want to help the farmer in our area learn how to be a businessman. And I want to help him understand what the demand is, how much it can be sold at a wholesale price for, and how he can make a good living staying on his farm doing it.
I think that you raised some really good points, and that's one thing that I think that we have found be very good for us is that we sell at a market directly at our farm in the city. So people come out and they meet the farmers who are working there. They get to walk out into the rows and see where the food is produced, ask questions, and make a relationship with the farmer there and have conversations and build a nice community around that commerce. We have a lot of very regular customers who really helped us out this past year and build good friendships with these people. And a lot of people who just found us at the Hootenanny at the end of the year, and they said, we're coming back next year. And that's really really rewarding for us and very exciting because we can see people who are very hungry for this local food and the experience of meeting the farmers and learning more and volunteering and donating and doing what they can do to help and getting inspired to do their own gardening. And there's thousands of different things that individuals can do. Yeah. And that's very exciting to see that.
One of the more enjoyable aspects of this is raising chickens. Chicken, you know, raising is a small-scale operation. It can be done in anybody's backyard. Chickens eat bugs. They eat bugs that would otherwise be eating your plants, your garden plants. And, you know, they produce compost, excellent fertilizer.
Yeah, earlier this year, Columbia modified its ordinances to allow citizens to raise 6 hens in their backyard. And that's been very successful, I think. I've talked to a lot of people who have gotten hens and have been very successful. And very pleased with how they've been. We've done several workshops. That's one of the things that we do is we did how to raise chicks from a young age. We've done processing workshops. We've done chicken coop building workshops. And they're very hands-on to get people who are interested in these things have these basic skills like how to process a bird. I mean, if you've never done it before, that's a fact of having chickens. as they get older, or if you brood them from chicks, you'll have some roosters. You don't want roosters in your backyard. You're not allowed to in the city. It's because they're just loud and annoying. So, yeah, a time will come when you need to do something with this chicken or with this rooster. So that's some of the basic things that we're trying to do, is to get that education out there and train people, encourage them to teach other people, so that these skills are out there.
Oh, if you don't mind me breaking in here, I would like to say that. And is it Alan?
Adam.
Adam, I'm sorry. I can't hardly hear. We had some really violent weather here at the start of the show, and my signal is not great. But we just got the ability pushed through City Council, the ability to have six hens in our backyard here in Springfield, too. So we're real excited about that. And I think this is indicative of a trend, and I'm kind of a data. I guess market analysis is more what I do for a living than anything. And this trend is got legs. I mean, this trend is going to be huge across the country. It's not just happening here. It is absolutely everywhere. And if we're smart, if we'll use this window of time to really put people online producing, doing the right PR and the right marketing to get it in, whether you use a CSA model or you use a fruit stand, veggie stand market model, whether you use the farmer's market model, or whether you direct, your produce and your product goes directly into a grocery store, this is the time to start making it happen right now. It couldn't, it's like the perfect storm for this.
Yes, and our time, I think, is finite. The ongoing collapse of the economy is proceeding at pace, and it will eventually impact our ability to feed ourselves if we continue to rely on the existing economic model. I think we have a caller. Can you hear me, caller? Is this Patricia?
Hey, Rich.
Hey.
This is Patricia.
Yeah, how are you doing?
Hey, Patricia.
Good. Hey, Janelle. This is a great show.
Minus the technical defects.
Minus the technical difficulties. Tornado in Missouri.
Uh-huh, Springfield.
Imagine that.
Scary.
Yeah. It's just, when I was talking, the rain and hail was banging on the car. I couldn't hear anything. It was really bad there for a minute, but it went over the top of us and hit at Stratford, which is about 5 miles to our east. So I guess we did okay.
Wow, we appreciate your dedication to be here.
Really? You could have been calling from Oz, you know.
No kidding. Well, you know how it is here in Missouri. It's that's just part of the deal. So it's you get used to them at my age.
So, Patricia, did you have anything to add about this?
Well, I'm just very interested in the food subject, and I think it ties in. We've talked before about pharmaceutical companies and how the top 10 pharmaceutical companies make more than all the other 490 Fortune 500 companies combined, and they want us to be, sick so that they can sell their products. But Hippocrates said, let food be your medicine. And that's what I do. I eat organic. We have a wonderful farmer's market here in my town. We have more health food stores per capita than any other city I've been in. And so I eat organic food, and it keeps me going just fine. I don't need any drugs. I don't even need, supplements or herbs or anything like that. If I want an herb, I go out in my garden and get some oregano or some thyme. But it's really important in my eyes that people learn how to take care of themselves in the way of using food as their medicine, and also taking care of, their own food needs. And it doesn't have to be that complicated. I think that if people can grow greens in their gardens, just in their backyards. I know people who have lived in almost an asphalt jungle who just have a few tiny little areas that are, have dirt in them, and they grow greens in those areas. And greens are really the core of the healthy diet, because chlorophyll is just one ion different than hemoglobin. So when you eat chlorophyll, it's almost like getting a blood transfusion, and you don't even need animal flesh at that point. You need that chlorophyll that the animals ate, and that therefore you eat secondhand by eating the animal. And I love chickens. I think they are so sweet as pets. And then also, they lay eggs every day, even when they're not fertilized, when they don't have roosters around. So I think that it would be so beautiful if everybody could have chickens. Unfortunately, I live in a condominium, so although I can grow greens, they kind of got a little bit miffed when I got some chickens. And they told me that they weren't appropriate pets here. Only dogs and cats were appropriate pets for us in this condominium. So I had to get rid of my chickens, and I really miss them. But, you know, that would be the easiest thing in the world for people to feed themselves if they had a few chickens and they had some greens. Of course, you have to keep the chickens and the greens separated, you know, for the most part, because
the chickens eat the greens.
Will strip your garden of all the good greens. But they love just, like your guest was saying, they like to just eat bugs and worms and the leftovers of your greens. So I think that, you know, it's a very important subject, food, and we really need to get out from under big box agriculture. And I love that you have these people on the program today. I think that this is really a wonderful program. So thank you.
Well,
that's
all,
really all I have to say right now.
I'm all pumped up to get out and grow my garden now, and here it is,
right.
November. I was wondering if each of our guests, Adam and Roel, could give us some information about, you know, here it is November, and what can we do during the winter, and how can we get involved. I grew up in Iowa, and I always helped my parents grow their garden or plant the garden, and this was my first year in a long time to grow my own garden, and it was a failure. I mean, it was a bad year to do it here, but, you know, I had a lot of gratitude after a handful of carrots. That's all I would have had to survive on for the year, and here we are going into the winter. Is there anything that we can do now to get ready for...
Sure. Right now is a good time for planting. Obviously, the growing season is wrapped up, and things are winding down. But in the fall time is a good, when it's really dry, is a good time to start a new garden, to till area, and then plant cover crops that grow deep roots, and then kind of let the plants do a lot of the work in getting it cultivated. And then in the spring, after you have all your plans laid out of what you're going to plant where, when you're going to plant it, those things take some time to invest into it to make sure that you have a good strategy to use the most of the land you have. Especially in cities, when land is limited, you need to utilize it very well and intensively.
So
to get the produce off of it, to actually get higher yields, you need healthier soil. That can be made by compost. Adding compost to your garden, copious amounts in the spring or at the end of the season in the fall, will help make sure that the nutrients are there in the soil, and then the building blocks for the plants, all those minerals and nutrients are there that can be assembled into larger, healthier plants. And you can, if you have that healthy soil, then you'll have healthy plants. That's the key. Whenever we do education, we say, before we talk about plants, we need to talk about soil. Healthy soil equals healthy plants. And they'll be able to fight off disease, they'll yield more, be drought tolerant, flood tolerant. And that's really key.
That's so important, because, you know, we want to plant and we want to pick things.
Yeah.
We really put the plant before the soil, so to speak, don't we?
That's right. Once you have that soil, that's something you can improve over time. That's really the key to success with small scale agriculture, is treating your land well and improving it from year to year.
So here locally in Columbia, how can people get a hold of you?
If you have anybody has questions, they can come. They can email us or go to our website. At ColumbiaUrbanAg.org. We're not at our market anymore because of the season, but once it gets warm, we'll be selling produce Monday, Wednesday, and Friday from 4 until about dark. at our farm at Smith and Fay Street, 1209 Smith. It's near Business Loop in College. Or email us and talk to us if you have questions. We consult with people all the time. We have a backyard garden service where we install gardens and we do landscaping, the whole range of things.
Hoop houses can extend the growing season significantly, can't they?
That's right. Yeah, we have a lot of things growing now under hoop house, but they were planted many weeks ago. But you're right.
You have to know your soil. Have your soil ready.
That's right. Well, that goes without saying, of course. That is a good model where you can extend the season in the fall later and then start earlier in the spring. That way you get more days of the year where food is growing.
One other thing, in Springfield, I was going to speak to the hoop house greenhouse issue. In metropolitan areas, a lot of warehouses are now being used for aquaponics. I don't know, I'm sure you're probably aware of that. The growing of fish, using the water to fertilize the plants. The fish eat from the plants. It's pretty much a closed situation. And in some metropolitan areas, those old warehouse situations are used to put that situation on and create a lot of product that then goes immediately, fish and produce, into the surrounding local restaurants. And it is just huge. I mean, if you haven't looked into it, look into that. I would also suggest, too, that some soil takes a lot of work to bring up to where it's going to be productive. And you might want to look into raised bed gardening and lasagna gardening, all those kinds of things where you can create a really good environment really quickly, really easily, and be most efficient in your production.
It just occurred to me that you could use these fish aquariums inside of a greenhouse to moderate the temperatures during the entire year.
That's exactly how it works. And as far as Wisconsin, they are using, aquariums the length of the greenhouse. The water heats up during the day, holds the temperature during the night so that it heats the greenhouse at night. It's just an incredible model. And by the way, too, I don't know, I mean, we never think of this, but you may be aware that Paris during the Second World War provided almost all of the produce for Europe. And Springfield is at the same longitude. So, I mean, we can grow with hoop house and greenhouse utilization. We can grow here year-round. I've been accused in my, of course, by the larger corporations and the big ag folks here in town, they scoff at us and say that, you know, you couldn't begin to feed the people here. And then I refer back to 100 years ago when right in my hometown was the center of one of the largest agrarian economies that ever was on this continent. And our grapes are in California. Our grapes are in France. We produce grapes. We produce tomatoes. Strawberries, tons of things. And we fed populations not only in Missouri, but all the way back to the East Coast. So, and then, of course, they will say, well, you know, you just want us to go back 100 years. No, what I want to do is use the model and all the technology we have to put an economic engine online that will be sustainable. If there's one thing I've learned, and if you fight and fight and fight and fight for legislation, it can be negated with one pinstroke. If you want to do something for real, quit worrying about the government. Get with the people in your area and put an economic engine in place, and that is the way to change things.
Amen.
It's amazing.
That's right.
Yay.
I like it.
Oh, by the way, may I give our website? Would you mind?
Please
no,
do.
Go ahead.
Please go ahead.
Because and you said in Adam, yours is. Columbia Urban Ag.org.
Yeah, that's correct.
.org. I'm going to remember. I don't have anything to write with. I'm sitting in my car. The Well-Fed Neighbors website is www.wellfedneighbor.com. And there's a social site there, and I am in the process of putting up a new site that kind of got in trouble somehow, and we've just got it resurrected. But if you would just remember Well-Fed Neighbor and go there, we're going to have a much larger web presence, and hopefully we want to speak to metropolitan areas all over Missouri. We would like Missouri to be the first state and the union that can once again feed itself.
Well, that's awesome. And I'd like to give people information about how to find Eats on Feet, which is like Meals on Wheels. So it's Eats on Eats on Feet. It was developed by a woman, a midwife in Phoenix, and now there's one for every state and multiple countries. And if you're on Facebook, just search for Eats on Feet Missouri, and you'll find the Missouri group. So, and this applies to anybody, even if you're a man that doesn't have children, you know somebody who has a baby, and you might know somebody who needs milk or somebody who has an excess of milk. And this is where women go, and they mother to mother share their breast milk so that every human being can have breast milk as the beginning of their health.
I need to do a station break for a minute, and we'll be right back.
I know what you're going through.
I've been there.
Nobody else I know has been there.
It's not easy being a veteran.
Coming back from Iraq or Afghanistan, I had been so excited to come home.
But it's harder than I thought.
Not everyone understands that.
Things at home may be as you left them.
But you don't feel the same.
Join us at communityofveterans.org.
And connect to others who are going through the same thing.
Because no one knows what it's like to come back unless they were there.
Brought to you by Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America and the Ad Council.
Hey, this is Robin Sylvester. I play bass with Bob Weir and Rat Dog. And you're on the Imagination Station, KOPN 89.5 FM.
And to get that out of the way, we have to identify ourselves periodically. So it's getting close to the top of the hour. The next show is waiting in the wings. And Patricia, do you have anything? We have like a minute to go. Do you have anything you want to add to this?
I just want to say this was a wonderful show with these wonderful guests. I think it's so important what they're all talking about. Thank you,
okay.
Everyone.
We need to come together as a community and start meeting our neighbors and turn off the TV and find out what's really going on in the world.
Amen. We like to say grow local, buy local, eat local, period.
Yes. Actually, let me interject this one little thing, since we do have 1 minute. It's been studied, you know, how other primates eat, and what they do is they eat half fruit, half greens, and that's, you know, and then, of course, when you're eating your greens, you know, you get some aphids, and when you're eating your fruit, you get some, you know, so they're, you know, they also eat a little bit of bugs, but we don't need a lot more than that, so when it comes down to it, all we really need is, you know, to grow some cucumber plants or have some apple trees and pear trees and some greens, and that will sustain us. So, you know, even if there was a huge weather problem or nuclear problem or something, right away, dandelions are going to be growing up through the cracks in the sidewalk. So nobody ever needs to starve, and that's my main message, is that, you know, we really don't have to worry about starving ever, you know, just because the big stores go broke or the transportation ceases or something. We really just need fruits and greens to be very healthy. So that's all I have to say. Thank you for asking.
Okay, well, thanks to everybody for joining in here. And
thank you, Rich.
Thank you.
Thanks.
See you next week.